I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Second Tuesday of the month, we check in with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Coming up in a little bit, we'll check in with WildCare for some thoughts on what to do if you come across baby birds or other wildlife. And, oh, listen, birdsong, it's increasing all the time.
Delightful.
Good morning, Mark.
It almost makes you forget it was in the 30s this morning.
I know.
more spring on Cape Cod, yeah.
I love that sound of the morning dove.
Yeah.
Such a nice sound.
Yeah, it just reminds me of my suburban childhood. Ooh, a wood thrush mixed in there.
Mm.
Not a common bird on the Cape. They're in Falmouth, but we don't really have them on the outer Cape.
Oh.
Chipping sparrow, song sparrow.
So, yeah, it's getting lively in the morning now.
It is getting lively in the morning. And this reminds me of the pub night we did on Nantucket, whenever that was, last week, the week before.
Yeah, April 26th, I think.
Yes, that's right. And it was really good to get over there and see my Nantucket friends. It's been way too long. And so our idea was we did, you know, you were there.
Yeah.
You remember.
We did a bird quiz.
We did the bird song quiz, which was a weird thing. That was new territory for me trying to do a bird song quiz in a crowded bar. But everybody
it's always a challenge.
Everybody was very polite and they listened. And I I made a major gaffe. I don't know if
you
remember.
Are you sure it wasn't just a trick question?
No, it was a major gaffe. I'm coming clean.
Okay.
And so, you know, I have this bird song workshop that I do, and there's a quiz at the end, and the things aren't labeled. The files, I just sort of click on them randomly. And I'm clicking on things, and this one song starts playing, and I'm getting blank stares from everybody in this Nantucket
they
crowd.
They knew what it was. They just knew it wasn't Nantucket.
I don't think they did. And there's a reason for that. And my wife is there, and she's whispering the answer. And I'm like, you have these in your backyard.
No, not on Nantucket.
It was tufted titmouse.
Right?
It's the one place in the state, and I know this, obviously, but I had just forgotten in the moment, there are no tufted titmice on Nantucket.
Yeah.
It's like the only place in the state,
and
it's because they don't like to fly over water, as you know. I mean, the vineyard has them. It's close enough to the mainland that they were able to colonize it, but they just hate flying over water, and they have never made it. They just can't seem to catch the ferry.
I was going to say, they're not going over the ferry. Yeah, and I guess they've come over the bridge here. I mean, people have seen them fly over the bridge.
Yeah, that people say that. Yeah, and I'm sure. I mean, they were...
At some point, they had to if they were going to not fly over the water.
Yeah, I mean, the canal's not that wide.
Yeah, that's
true. I mean, if they can get to Martha's Vineyard, they can get over the canal. Even chickadees don't like flying over water. And I've seen people, or people have seen chickadees in the fall when they do move around and disperse and migrate a little bit and kind of bunched up on one side, on the Scusset side of the canal, like flying out a little bit, then losing their nerve and flying back, flying out a little further. Then they lose their nerve and eventually they get over. So some of these birds that don't migrate long distances, are really wimpy about flying over water. So apologies to my Nantucket friends for this trick question. I mean, I know there are no titmice there, but I forgot in the moment.
Right. So we've had a little bit of stormy weather, and that often brings in some birds that we're not expecting. And you're seeing some interesting visitors at the sanctuary banding station, right?
Yeah, literally up to the minute. I just got a text from Elora Graham, our assistant bander. We've had so I talked a couple of weeks ago in one of the bird reports about this idea of overshoot migrants, these spring overshoot migrants. And so these are birds that we should never expect to see here because they breed way south of us. They're southeastern breeding warblers and raptors and things. But what happens is there are certain weather phenomena where they can get caught up in packets of air that are moving up this way and overshoot their normal breeding range as they're migrating north, their normal migration north, but they get caught in these northward moving packets of air and they can end up 1,000 miles north of where they're supposed to be. And birders here benefit from that. And so it really brightens up an April day when suddenly there's a prothonotary warbler on Martha's Vineyard. Mm. And we've had some really good luck with those spring overshoot migrants, these southeastern species, at the sanctuary in Wellfleet. And we have this banding station. It's been re-upped and has been operational for a few years now. And in the last week and a half, we've had three different pretty rare southern warblers show up at the banding station. We had a yellow-throated warbler first. Beautiful bird, yellow throat, black mask, very rare. And then a hooded warbler, another rare southern. I've not seen one at the sanctuary that I can remember. I haven't seen any of these three species. And then The other day, a Kentucky warbler, the rarest of the rare of these southern birds, showed up.
Do they hang around or not?
Well, yeah, this Kentucky warbler, I think, has been recaptured twice now. So it's and that's what's great about the banding is it highlights that birds that we wouldn't see otherwise, and we're just birding around. I've never seen a Kentucky warbler or a hooded warbler at the sanctuary, but when you put these nets out, it sort of shines a light on species that are skulking around and using the sanctuary that we didn't know about. And when you recapture them, as happened with this Kentucky warbler, we know that they're staying.
Yeah.
And so he's hanging out, fattening up. I don't know what his next move is going to be. He can't continue further north. This is well north of where they would breed. But they recaptured that Kentucky warbler two different times since, I think, the 4th, including
wow.
this morning. It's still there today.
Wow.
And people can do – we have public banding demonstrations on Saturday mornings, and I think they're going to be starting up on Wednesdays as well. There might even be one tomorrow if you check the sanctuary, call up the sanctuary. You can get in on one of these public banding demonstrations. And our banders are awesome. They do a great job just educating people about
what's out there, yeah.
why we do it, and you get to see birds in the hand. You get to see them process the birds and maybe help with the release of a bird. But yeah, that's been really yeah. interesting. And then one of my favorites is maybe my favorite is the swallow-tailed kite is one of these overshoot migrants that sometimes show up in April, May, into June sometimes. And so that's it's like the best raptor in the world. I mean, these things are just I used to point these out to people when I lived in Florida, and I would say, look at that bird. How can you not like birds? I mean, it's the most graceful hawk in the world. Long, pointed wings, a striking black and white plumage, this long, ridiculous swallow tail, this big scissor tail they have, and they just live on the wing. They're just unspeakably graceful, and they live on the wing. They pick dragonflies out of the air, or they'll swoop down kind of effortlessly and grab a snake off of a shrub or something like that. And, you know, we don't get them very often here, but there was one at Mass Audubon's Pilgrim Heights Hawk Watch that we run with our stalwart volunteer of many years, Don Manchester. He just kind of stands alone up there at Pilgrim Heights in North Truro in the National Seashore and counts hawks migrating through in the spring. And he was rewarded mightily with
yeah.
this swallow-tailed kite that came by, I don't remember the exact day, and I don't know if it's been seen since, but that's the third different sighting of this very much southeastern. I mean, this yeah. bird should not be up here. They don't even this is too cold for them because it's a bird that migrates. Even the Central American population migrates south for the winter.
Oh, is that right?
So wow. the ones that breed in Costa Rica are like, ooh, getting too chilly.
Oh.
Time to head south into the Amazon. Like, this is not a hardy bird. And so the fact that they're up here is clearly it's a navigational error of some sort, and they can't stick around.
Tell us more about this hawk watch. Is that something that you do a certain time of day, or can you do that any time of day?
Dawn is generally there in the mornings. It's better when things kind of warm up in the morning. Southwest winds is what you want, like a warm day after a warm bubble of air. Mm-hmm. That kind of brings the migrants in from the south. We get broadwing hawks coming through there. That's not a common bird on the Cape. We don't get to see the broadwing hawk migration, the fall migration that they get off Cape. We don't get to see that on the Cape. But we get a few in the spring, and Dawn counts those. A lot of turkey vultures come through, a lot of kestrels, mm-hmm. a lot of sharpshin hawks. And it's, you know, this is citizen science really at its best. Dawn's an expert and this data all goes to Eastern Mass Hawk Watch and the Hawk Migration Association of North America, HMANA. Mm-hmm. I used to do counts for them. And so this all goes into databases that, a lot of people have looked at for, looking at trends and just kind of general raptor population research. So it's not yeah. just for fun.
Is it my imagination or does it seem like they're the hawk population and not, I don't mean any particular, like the red-tailed hawks, the Cooper's hawks, sharpshins, they seem to be more of them in recent years. Is that just I'm noticing them more or are their populations up?
It's hard to say. I mean, what seems to be happening, and this is in part coming from analysis of the Hawk Watch data, is that in the winter, some of these species like sharpshin hawk, Cooper's hawk, that used to fly further south, are short-stopping.
Mm-hmm.
The winters are milder, and there's all kinds of bird bird feeding stations where they can pick off your mourning doves. And so they're not flying as far south. And as a result, you're seeing these big dips in the numbers at hawk migration sites. Yeah. And so, like, is the population crashing? But looking at other data, it seems, no, they're just not going as far south. Red tails seem to be more common now.
Yeah, they do, don't they? Yeah.
20 years ago. I'm not sure if that's real.
So we are seeing some migrants arriving earlier. And some are changing their arrival dates. And does this have to do with climate change, I'm assuming, and the temperatures and weather and all of that?
Yeah, so this is one of those truisms. And, you know, people who study birds or pay attention to birds, I think you're kind of generally aware of this phenomenon where birds are arriving earlier. And there's been a lot of research about this. But when you think about it and you think about the breeding biology of birds, it's like, okay, they're arriving earlier, but some of these birds are wintering in Central America. What's the mechanism? How do they know to arrive earlier? They have no idea what the weather is here when they're starting their migration from Colombia or the Caribbean. And so it turns out that the signal is strongest with short distance migrants that have more kind of flexibility in when they migrate. So, you know, a bird that only goes as far south as Georgia or the Carolinas or something like that, as opposed to a species that flies to Tierra del Fuego. And there's been some interesting research into this, actual data monitoring individual birds over time. And some folks in Iceland were looking at black-tailed godwits, this gorgeous, big, lanky sandpiper that is a pretty common breeder in Iceland. And they followed individuals over time, and they found this interesting pattern where at the population level, the migration, the first migrants were arriving back in the spring significantly early overall. But when they looked at individual birds weren't changing when they arrive.
Huh.
So what's the mechanism? How do they know if a, you know, a bird that they follow it for 10 years and it doesn't change when its arrival date at all during those 10 years, what is accounting for it? And it turns out it's the young birds.
Hmm.
And they think that it's a relatively short distance migrant, I guess, for a shorebird. And so because the adults are breeding, they're able to breed earlier because of earlier springs. Chicks are fledging earlier, and that is changing when the young birds come back in their first spring.
Yeah.
So it's the young birds that this is acting on. So that was kind of interesting because nobody had really explained how this is happening, how some birds are able to shift their migration. And there are lots of problems that can come about from changes in the spring being disconnected from when you're arriving. If you're a long-distance migrant and you can't change when you arrive, then there's been a lot of talk of, well, the insects are peaking earlier, but the birds aren't there to take advantage of it, so they're going to see nesting failures and that kind of thing. So there's all kinds of potential problems that can arise if there's a disconnect between spring phenology of flowering and insect abundance and when you're migrating. So,
or the like the red knots with the horseshoe crabs, if they don't time that
right,
they're in trouble.
Right, exactly. If things get out of phase, then you can have population level problems. And so, you know, everything is more complicated when you look at it species by species, but there's a lot of potential for problems. And it just seems like short distance migrants are doing a better job. They have enough flexibility built into their life history that they can arrive earlier and kind of take advantage of the changing climate.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk baby birds after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Our toll-free number for your bird comments, questions, or stories, or other wildlife, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, so nesting season, is it in full swing at this point? What are we likely seeing in our backyards right now?
Yeah, well, it comes in phases, right? So there are local birds that don't really migrate, things like house finches and Carolina wrens and titmice, even bluebirds, which are very short-distance migrants. Bluebirds could have chicks now. You know, we have some at the sanctuary that have been on eggs for a while. So we're in that kind of the local resident species are nesting, and so baby bird season is now, and it's gonna it'll continue. And migrants are still arriving. You know, the last few days of April, we saw our first great crested flycatchers all kind of poured in, orioles, hummingbirds. I had my first one on, I want to say, April 28th, but they haven't become regular at my feeders until the last few days. That's the first kind of wave of migrant birds, and so now they're getting down to nesting, but probably don't even have eggs yet. Orioles won't have eggs for a little bit.
What about robins?
Robins are short-distance migrants. It's a good question. They're definitely nesting now. Mm-hmm. I've gotten some calls about nests with eggs. And so, you know, and it's going to be like this. It has begun.
Yep.
And so this is baby bird season.
It's a baby bird season.
Right. And so that's why I'm excited to talk to Stephanie Ellis from WildCare.
We've got Stephanie Ellis joining us on the phone. She's the executive director of wildlife rehabilitator at WildCare. Good morning, Stephanie. Are you there? All right. Well, they're.
Do I have to pretend to be Stephanie?
No, they're trying to figure out the phone in there. Oh, there we go. I think I hear her. Stephanie, are you there?
I am here.
Yeah, yay! We got you.
Hey, hello, Stephanie.
So you get busy now with everybody. You know, when they people kind of assume when they see a baby bird or a little baby squirrel kind of on their own that it's orphaned, but that's not always the case, right?
That is so true, and something that we do at WildCare is we try to prevent over rescues, which is, you know, bringing in an animal that doesn't actually need help because sometimes they don't.
So how do you know?
Well, so it depends. For example, baby birds, like Mark was saying, the robins are sitting on eggs right now and house finches have started hatching. And so if people find a baby bird on the ground, it's important that they ask themselves a few questions. Is it naked, blind, or helpless? Naked meaning that it doesn't have feathers yet and it would be pink. And, you know, this is a really critical stage because it is dependent on the adult birds to keep it warm. And so if you find a pink, naked bird on the ground, it's important that you get it warm. And if you know where the nest is, you can place the bird back into the nest, but only if it's active, warm, you know, begging, and has life in it. If you don't know where the nest is, we're probably going to have you bring the baby in because it's really important that the parents would come back immediately so that they can brood this bird and keep it warm.
Yeah.
If you find a partially feathered baby bird on the ground, that's a little bit of a different story. If it's active, you can try to place it back into its nest. If the nest has fallen, but you know the approximate vicinity of where the nest was, we tell people to put the nest or put the bird into a basket. Baskets are great because you can hang them and they're porous, so if it rains, it's not going to collect with water. And you can hang the babies in the basket near where the nest was. But again, it's really critical to make sure the parents are coming back. So I always tell people, watch from a distance, keep your cats and dogs indoors if you can, keep your kids indoors if you can,
yeah.
Admire from a distance, and make sure, you know, for the featherless birds, putting them back in the nest, I would say if the parents are not back within 20 minutes, 40 minutes, then, you know, that bird's going to get cold. When they have a little bit of feathering, you can leave them a little longer, and the parents should be back pretty immediately, and so that's important.
Yeah.
And so my final one is it feathered? Is it running around on the ground and the parents are feeding it? Because robins, for example, they are on the ground, you know, days before they can actually fly. And this is like the rambunctious teenager stage, you know, where they're out driving and and they don't have much experience yet.
Yeah, and they end up in window wells. I feel like, and they split them up. So there'll be one kind of in one spot and one over hanging out under this other shrub and then one 50 yards somewhere else. And they have this particular call they make, those just out of the nest robin fledglings. Little call that kind of lets the adults know where they are.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And you'll see if you watch from a distance again that the parents will be coming in and feeding them. If you absolutely feel like you must intervene, you know, if you have a dog that goes out every hour and you can't keep him in, obviously, I tell people if you feel good about putting them in a low brush, that's fine. Just don't move them from the area. You want the parents to find them. And don't give baby birds food or water.
Right. I know. It seems counterintuitive.
No water either?
No water. I tell people this because, for one, if they're cold, they're not going to be able to digest the food. And also, if they're cold, they're probably pretty lifeless. Mm-hmm. And so it's really easy for babies to aspirate fluids mm-hmm. and food into their lungs. They basically breathe it into their lungs. And so, you know, when they come into wild care, the very first thing we do, even if they're begging, feed me, feed me, is warm those little buggers up.
Yeah.
They have to be warm, and then we hydrate them. And even for experienced caretakers, it's difficult to hydrate a bird. You know, it would be like giving a baby a syringe with water in it. Mm-hmm. They'd probably choke. So it's the same thing.
And you have a tried and true trick for keeping birds warm, right?
We do, yes. And this is something that everyone can do at home. Everyone has socks, and most people have dried rice or dried beans in their house. So what you can do is take a sock, fill it with dried rice, tie off the end, and if you put that in the microwave for about a minute, it becomes what I like to call an Instamom. it's instant warmth, an instant mother. And that can also be used to warm, you know, small baby mammals, your children, whatever you'd like to use it to warm. It works really well. Just be sure, of course, you don't want to place it on top of the bird.
Right.
You want to put it near them in their box or basket.
Yeah. What about baby squirrels? I imagine you get a lot of those this time of year, too.
We do. We have over 40 baby squirrels right now.
Oh, my gosh, and, 40.
I know. It's amazing, and there's so much work. The baby birds, at least, they eat from dawn until dusk. But the baby squirrels, it's like humans. They need to eat round the clock. So we have 40 right now, and we have dedicated volunteers who come in every 3 hours and feed babies. And also our staff are feeding them, feeding the especially the neonatal squirrels. Yeah. They need to be fed around the clock.
Is it the same thing? Like when you're trying to figure out if, you know, mom squirrel is, you know, really got hit by a car or something. I mean, how do you know if a squirrel is really abandoned or not?
Yes. So it's similar. I have to say squirrel moms are the best. They will take their kids back. They'll even take other squirrel kids back that don't belong to them. So if you find a baby squirrel on the ground, again, if it's pink, you know, unfurred, you're going to need to get that squirrel warm. If the mother is around, we tell people that you can leave it in a box with the heat warmer and watch for the mother to return. In the case of a single pink squirrel, you know, more often than not, we're going to have you bring it in. Mm-hmm. Because, again, that's an animal that needs its mother for warmth. It would not survive very long on its own.
Right.
If you find a squirrel with fur on it, you can leave that, again, in a box for the mother to return within a couple of hours. But the most important thing is, you know, at this time of year, unfortunately, people are trimming their trees and cutting down trees, and they may not realize that there was a nest in it.
Yeah.
So if you have the unfortunate experience of cutting down a tree only to find out that there was a nest of baby squirrels in it, you can leave them in a box, even at the base of the tree that no longer exists. And more often than not, the mother will return for them.
Oh, wow.
Right. They have multiple people are probably familiar with those big leafy balls up in your trees, those squirrel nests. And Stephanie was pointing out the other day that they'll have multiple nests, and sometimes different nests serve different purposes, right?
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, so she has other apartments to move the children into. So I'm not saying cut down the trees. Please don't. But if that happens, you know, call us. We have a wildlife helpline, 240-2255, and we'll walk you through it. It's like live counseling for the squirrels. And, you know, you need to just make sure they're warm and watch for the mother to come. And more than likely, she'll grab them and stick them in another net.
Do you have other baby animals, too? I mean, we're talking squirrels and birds, but now I'm wondering if you have 40 squirrels, are you seeing, like, chipmunks and other things, too?
We do, yes. Actually, I'm speaking to you from my apartment, and I'm currently nursing a baby vole.
Oh, wow.
A vole. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. And I guess...
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say, and I guess we should, it's probably good to mention that you, unless you have a license as a rehabilitator, you're not supposed to be taking these squirrels into your house and keeping them.
Yes. Thank you for saying this. It is illegal in the state of Massachusetts for you to have wildlife, most wildlife, in your possession. And also, you know, if you take a baby squirrel home and feed it cow's milk, it's going to get incredibly ill. Mm. And what we see at WildCare occasionally is that someone tries to take, you know, rehab into their own hands, and then they have this really sick baby and bring it to us, and it may not survive because it didn't receive the proper nutrition that it should have.
Right.
So
I remember being at a meeting, it was like a horseshoe crab meeting or something, and somebody is sitting at this meeting with a little baby goldfinch. It was one of those things, and this is the classic thing that people do. My neighbor said it was and so they thought it was some warbler or something. Everyone seems to have a neighbor who thinks they know about wildlife for some reason, and everybody implicitly trusts that neighbor for whatever reason. My neighbor said it, and so these people were trying to feed this poor baby goldfinch dog food.
Oh, no.
And goldfinches, and it was sort of tragic, it was very sickly, and goldfinches are one of the few songbirds that don't feed their young insects. They're, like, entirely seed eaters. That's why they breed in late summer and wait for the seed heads to come out on some of the flowers. So leave it to the experts.
Yeah. All right. Stephanie is the executive director and a wildlife rehabilitator at WildCare. Stephanie, thanks so much for being with us this morning. It was helpful information.
So before you go, I think there was something going on at Karoo in East Ham you wanted to talk about.
Tell us about that.
That's correct. Yes. WildCare has a fundraising dinner tomorrow evening at Karoo Restaurant in East Ham, and it's really exciting. It's a three-course dinner, wine pairing, and we also have a live owl presentation with a screech owl named Nickerson. Mm. So I'm excited to tell you about this because we only have 5 spaces left.
Oh.
So if you would like to attend,
better hurry.
Call us.
All right. Stephanie, thanks again. We appreciate your time this morning.
Thanks, Stephanie.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Mindy and Mark. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. John is on the phone from whale watching. Is John still there? John, are you there?
John.
Yes, yay. Thanks for holding on, John. Thanks for holding. I'm always excited when you call because you always have some great information, which you're seeing
John
out there.
Yeah.
And I was thinking this morning, I was wondering about the whales because it's been kind of really hopping out there in Cape Cod Bay.
Right.
Wow. And we go from Barnstable Harbor out to see the whales. So this year has been a real challenge, even when we're in the bay. We're under a speed restriction because of the critically endangered North Atlantic right whale. And we have had tons of them, pardon the pun, to maneuver around and to avoid. But I was calling this morning, and good morning, by the way, nice to talk to you as well, with an observation from the boat, with a concern, and then an anecdote. So I'll start with the sightings from the boat. We've had lots of right whales, as I said, and there have been bay whales as well at times. Here for the early bloom of plankton, particularly the copepods that they feed on.
Did you say say whales?
Yeah, say there was like 40 of them in the bay. Yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting. That's kind of an obscure species that most people aren't aware of. They look a lot like a fin whale, but the experts can tell the difference.
Yeah, they're amazing, and even we've got a lot of years of experience. And the other day, it took us about 10 minutes and a few surfacings to actually ID the say whale that we saw until it began side lunge feeding on plankton, and was soon joined by a right whale that we didn't know was in the area. That's why we go slow. And we did a hasty retreat when it turned and began feeding in toward the boat. But interestingly, on a bird note, this is the second year, not in a row, consecutive, that when we have got close quarter observation of these right whales, they often feed just below the surface and they produce an area of disturbed water from the water they displaced. We call it funny water, and that's what we're watching for to often clue you into their presence. And along the edges of this, we had red phalaropes, and they're feeding, I guess, on the plankton that's being displaced and put close to the surface. And this is the second time that I've seen this, so really neat when you're talking about sort of obscure timings of migrations. It's interesting to think that, you know, perhaps some of their foraging as they head north to their breeding grounds might be tied to, you know, some of the activities of our right whales and the way specifically that they feed.
Boy, that's really interesting.
We begin running every day.
Yeah. Is anybody keeping track of those sightings or getting photos? That's a really uncommon bird, and you know there aren't a lot of people on the water at the right time, and certainly nobody is seeing red phalaropes from land or on land and anywhere. So that's a really interesting sighting. It'd be good to collect some of that data if you're seeing them regularly.
Yeah, that is. We don't see them regularly, and again, we can't approach them when they're feeding, but because they're all buffed up in their finest right now, they're an easy separation from the rednecks, and they're, you know.
I'll have to enlist the Center for Coastal Studies folks to send me red phalarope pictures, because that's a really cool shorebird and one you don't see very often. Those are the ones, they go back to the Arctic and breed, and they're famous for, they spin in circles in these Arctic pools, and they create the vortex that brings the midges and the mosquito larvae up to the surface. They spin. But they winter and migrate well offshore, so they're pretty obscure species to most of us.
Yeah.
That's cool sighting.
John, I got a question for you about, in regards to the right whales. I know that you're supposed to keep, 500 yards from them in the boat. So when you have them come, do you just kind of stop when they're approaching? I mean, when they have so many of them in the bay, what do you have to do to kind of keep your distance?
We have a lot of experienced pairs of eyes on board. Including observers from whale and dolphin conservation. My captain's got, you know, 30 years experience watching these animals. I've got about 20, of being working around whales, so we're always watching. But they don't act like other whales, and they can come up anywhere. So mariners, keep your eye out, especially for odd patches of water. Now, most of them, according to the aerial surveys, have left the bay.
Right.
But there will always be a couple that find patches of plankton, and they'll hang out. So that's a warning, because we've got to give them their spaces. I think now only 523 of them left.
Yeah, right.
And as John said, they have lifted the restrictions.
My concern is, and I'm looking out my window now at our oriole feeder. We put out sectioned oranges or half oranges, and then a little cup of grape jelly, which the orioles love. Our catbirds here in the yard love, and we also have a one robin, one blue jay, one titmouse, and one red-bellied woodpecker that will come in for a little bit of the jelly.
Wow. So, all right. An abrupt transition to backyard birds from John, out of nowhere.
So what's your concern?
It's amazing. And, in fact, my orioles, I call them jam junkies, because they just get in on the jelly and they love it. They'll be here now while they're starting their nest, then they'll disappear for about 3-4 weeks as they're having their broods and then feeding their kids insects to get them pumped up, and then all the kids come. And we'll go through sometimes 2 jars of jelly, in a couple days.
Wow.
Yikes.
It's crazy. But here's my concern. I shared this with a friend who built a feeder, and I have a wooden dowel that comes out that we put half oranges on. And my friend went ahead and made one, told me about it, was proud of it. He used a metal spike, and that's something for anyone looking to do this, you don't want to do, because they can damage their bills on it or their beaks on it. That really, I kind of gave him please.
Have you seen that happen? Have you seen them damage their beaks on the metal? I'm not sure I've heard of that.
Yeah, and I've actually seen some photos online of it. So if you're doing that, if it's metal that you're using, you stand a chance of potentially hurting the bird's beak. So I thought I'd throw that out there as a concern, because it's like taking your bird watching to bird feeding to a whole new level.
Yeah, sounds like it's an exciting little spot to watch.
Final, my anecdote is, a couple of years ago, I was lucky enough to be down in Peru, and we were on a section of the new road that goes coast to coast from Brazil all the way across to Lima, Peru. And I looked up and got a swallow-tailed kite, and I love that bird. I'm with you.
Yeah. It's a good ambassador bird.
And I counted 42 of them in a count.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a
sight.
They
were pretty high. Yeah. But I got some photos of different birds. But wow, that was kind of blew me away. I was good for the rest of the day. I was smiling for about a week.
Yeah, I bet. John, thanks for calling. We always appreciate hearing from you. Thanks for the phone call. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Mark Faraday, Science Coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. Our toll-free number for your bird comments, your critter, any kind of critter. We'll talk about any kind of critters. All critters. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, we've got an email, and this is from Nancy. She says, egrets and yellow legs have been passing through. Where do they go to breed?
Where do they go? That's a good question. They go to very different places. Yellow legs are big, long-legged sandpipers that are pretty common in salt marshes, especially on the Cape in spring and fall migration. But then by June, they're gone, like all the other migratory shorebirds. And where do they go? So they go further north to kind of subarctic tundra with kind of low stunted spruce trees and things like that. And we see pictures of them in the breeding grounds in, you know, northern Canada. They're often perched on the top of a tree singing. You know, we see them as shorebirds acting like sandpipers, running around in mud flats inside salt marshes and eating, you know, whatever, marine invertebrates. But they will, up on the breeding grounds, they will get up on top of a tree and sing. And so they're heading to northern Canada, like so many of our migratory shorebirds. And wading birds, we don't really have a lot of colonies on the Cape outside of Monomoy. So Monomoy National Wildlife Refuge has small numbers of these colonial wading birds. And so herons and egrets are generally colonial nesters. So they nest in big, often noisy, mixed colonies with multiple species together. And there are some left. Kettle Island up in Essex County is one of the biggest, some of the harbor islands. There are some colonies, some nice wading bird colonies left that have things like snowy egrets and great egrets and the occasional little blue heron or one of the more rare ones. Black-crowned night herons nest in colonies. Some of them are not as colonial. Yellow-crowned night heron is a rare one that will kind of nest on its own. Green herons are not colonial. They nest by themselves in the woods somewhere near a wetland. Great blue herons tend to nest in great blue heron colonies without other species so much. In Massachusetts, they like to nest in like old beaver swamps. There are no colonies on the Cape. Now, you can see great blue herons any month of the year on Cape Cod.
But
they'll overwinter. They're here in migration, post-breeding dispersers in the summer, failed breeders. Every month of the year we have them, but there are no great blue heron breeding colonies, no rookeries here on the Cape.
Where's the closest?
Probably in Plymouth somewhere. Yeah. I think there are a lot. Plymouth has a lot of woods, big woods, and I think there are some colonies here and there that I don't personally know about. I was in Plymouth yesterday, and I could see great blue herons flying around, and indication that they're moving from feeding areas to the colony. There's a famous one on Route 2 if you're going west of Boston, kind of near Concord. And it's this classic. It's an old, probably beaver swamp with a lot of dead trees in the standing water. And they'll build their nests at the tops of those dead trees.
That's a cool sight.
It is a cool sight. And those are the places where usually one pair of great horned owls comes in January and February and takes over one of those nests. and the great blue herons just sort of, they don't mess with them. Yeah. You know, they come back and take over the rest of the nests in April and get down to business. They just sort of ignore that one great horned owl that's nesting over in the side of the colony.
Intimidating. Those great horned owls are a little bit intimidating. Yeah. All right, let's talk to Carol, who's giving us a call from Sandwich. Hi, Carol.
Hi. Mike, I have a question. I'm having my trees, my two big maples, actually the whole yard, sprayed for the gypsies. Mm-hmm. And I wondered, the fellow that's doing it insists that it will not hurt the birds or the bees. Can I believe him?
Do you know what he's using?
Yeah, what are you spraying?
Do you know what he's using to spray?
I don't know.
Spinosad or whatever.
He's a professional.
Yeah. I'd just ask him about that.
Aware of what know what the habitat is in the area, and it won't hurt anything.
Yeah. They're always going to say that. Yeah. They're selling you a product. But so what? It's not like they're an independent scientist. You know, they're just like, yeah, it's fine. We can buy our services. But you know, in some cases, they use things that are considered organic. The Bacillus thuringiensis, the BT. Is a naturally occurring bacteria that affects larval stages of lepidopterans, and I don't know if they're using that. Spinosad has become the kind of common thing that they spray, and that's, you know, from another, it's a derivative, I don't know as much about this as I should, but it's a derivative of some naturally occurring bacteria, or it's some kind of bacterial toxin or something. I'd have to look into that more, but so they can say that these are naturally occurring and organic. Anything you're going to use, I don't care if you pour salt on something or use vinegar to kill weeds, these are all chemicals. And if they work, then they are killing things. You know, they're a harsh chemical in some way if they're going to be effective.
I think it also has to do with the time, you know, that they spray and all
right.
Of that,
there are times when you can use the BT, and then times when the spinosad is better.
You know, when the bees aren't buzzing.
Well, so are you
going to happen next week? So,
so
all of a sudden, I'm hearing you talk about all the baby birds nesting and all. And I'm thinking, oh boy.
So why? So what kind of trees do you have? And did something happen
We have mostly a huge maple, a lot of little maples, oaks. And they're completely decimated by this moth larvae last year and the year before, so that I was afraid we were going to lose them. I talked to somebody at one of the tree centers, and they said they can take 3 years of that defoliation, and then they'll die.
Yeah, so you are a good candidate for spraying.
Yeah. You know what I would do if I were you, Carol? I'd give a call over to the county extension office and talk with one of the master gardeners over there, and they can really tell you about your options. You could be, you got the winter moth and the gypsy moth. I'm not sure which ones you had decimating your trees, but I would give them a call over at the county extension.
Okay.
It's a tough thing.
Give me an idea of who would spray.
Well, they can give you an idea of what's good to use, and maybe what's the best for your trees. And you tell me a problem, and they can tell you what your options are.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll just tell you to use spinosad. I mean, there's kind of
what is it called again? I'll ask them.
Spinosad.
Yeah.
Ends with a D. Spinosad. It's not DDT. I mean, not all chemicals are created equal. Some are better than others, and I think it seems to have come to the top as one of the best tools for fighting gypsy moths. When you're at risk of losing your trees altogether, it's a decision you made. You want to spray. I don't love seeing the spraying because, I just wonder what else it's killing. And I know this is the time of year the warblers are coming through our neighborhoods and going through our oaks and probing for insects in those flowers. And I wonder about kind of what impacts it might be having on
them. I worry about the bees, too.
Definitely.
The bees. I mean, the bees are struggling for a lot of different reasons. Yeah. And so I commend
Carol,
you for
thanks for
thinking
of our
it.
Little pollinators and our
exactly.
birds, and good luck. Hopefully you'll get some answers from the County Extension Office.
Thanks for calling.
Sure.
Bye-bye.
We've got to mention Birdathon's coming up, Mass Audubon's Birdathon.
Birdathon.
And
get excited.
And you get so competitive in this.
I get very competitive.
You want to win.
My team is sort of hurting this year. A lot of my ringers are otherwise occupied this year, but we're going to fight the good fight. And so Birdathon is this annual fundraiser for Mass Audubon, and it pits us against each other.
within the organization. Sanctuary.
Sanctuary against sanctuary, brother against brother. And we're all competing to both see the most birds in 24 hours and raise the most money. It's obviously this is a fundraiser. This is the kind of thing where we're nonprofits. We're always looking for ways to fund the good work that we're trying to do out there. And we're trying to raise some money for our bird banding station at the sanctuary and other things. And we've got some awesome team members who have been doing good work raising money. If you go to the website, you can find the fundraising pages for Wellfleet Bay or whatever your favorite sanctuary is, Long Pasture, Felix Neck, and all the different, find your local sanctuary that you want to support, find their Birdathon page, or other organizations. I mean, whatever your local organization is that is doing conservation work that you want to support, there are other a-thons out there. I think there's a Nantucket Birdathon. I can't remember when that is. I thought somebody said it was the week after ours. It used to be the same week as Mass Audubon's Birdathon. Manomet does one in the fall. So just be aware of your local conservation organizations and the fundraisers they're doing. And this week it's Mass Audubon. So please think about supporting
us. And eBird always wants to know what you're seeing too.
Oh, eBird.
Yeah, eBird. So, they've got the Global Bird Day or
eBird has stolen some of my best birders. So, eBird does this global big day now.
That's it, global
and
big
it's all,
day.
It always seems to be the same weekend as Mass Audubon's Birdathon. And so my friends that work for eBird at Cornell are doing things like birding in Guatemala now, because, and they're doing a good job of this. And they are promoting eBird in these kind of developing markets for birding tourism, like Guatemala and Peru, places like this, trying to get the local birders and guides using eBird more. And you know that I'm all for that. I use eBird when I go to those countries and I look at the data, and the data is very useful to biologists as well as birders. So it's a good cause in their end too.
All right, let's squeeze Cinda in, calling from Fairhaven. Hi, Cinda.
Hi, how are you folks doing this morning?
Great. Very
good. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Just a real quick information about praying for worms and moth larvae. Spinosa is toxic to bees. It can only be used when bees are at rest.
Right.
There is a reentry period for that. I'm not exactly sure what it is. There is BT, which is a virus. It's easily obtainable. Bonnie has a liquid form. And that works very well on small larvae. Also, there's a product named Garlic Barrier, which is pure garlic, and it's certified by Omri, which is an organic certification company. They say whether you can use it or not if you're certified organic.
Yeah.
And that can be sprayed at almost any time of the day. And it is effective against larvae and mosquitoes, and you can use it on many garden plants. Repel insects. A lot of people are told that Spinosad is not toxic.
You want to check it out. And Cinda, I really appreciate calling in for that. And, you know, we've got Roberta Clark coming in next Tuesday. Roberta's our horticulturist and entomologist. And we'll ask Roberta for her thoughts on some of this as well.
Cinda is correct, I should say. It is highly toxic to bees.
Yeah, so you got to be really careful. That's right. And that's why I came back to the timing. You've got to make sure you're spraying when the bees are not
flies,
right.
Butterflies, right. And moths. Yeah.
Mark Faraday is the science coordinator at Mass Audubon's Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary. He's here the second Tuesday of every month. We'll see you next month, Mark.
See you next time.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.